Hello and welcome to the Gandhara Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties podcast focusing on Pakistan and Afghanistan. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host in Washington, D.C. It's been a while since the news about infiltration of so-called Islamic State militants being discussed in Afghanistan. The group even has a name for the region. They call it Khorasan Province. But despite their efforts, control of IS is limited with few tiny areas in eastern Afghanistan. Nevertheless, lately, Afghan officials are expressing serious concerns about the group, and that concerns has to do with the group's ability to spike up sectarian attacks in Afghanistan, the latest of which we have seen on November 21st attack in Kabul against minority Shiites. On this episode of our bi-weekly Gandhara podcast, we will look into IS's infiltration to the region, the potential threat that it allegedly poses, its possible objectives and result of the efforts to curtail their advance in the region. Joining me to discuss the subject are Marwin Wimbaum, former State Department analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan and senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Marwin, welcome to Gandhara.
Good morning.
Good morning.
To you all.
Good morning. And joining us from London, Christopher Colinda, senior military fellow at the King's College. Christopher, welcome to Gandhara.
Thank you very much for having me.
Very nice to have you. Hikmatullah Azami, researcher at the Center for Conflict and Peace Studies in Kabul, is joining us. Mr. Azami, welcome to Gandhara.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you.
Good evening, since it's an evening in Kabul.
Very nice to have you. And my colleague, Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, which focuses on Pakistan in Afghanistan, is joining us. Abu Bakr, welcome to the Gandhara.
Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you, gentlemen. Before to kick off the debate, let me remind you that please feel free to amplify, expand, or disagree directly with the points that our guests are making. Please don't wait for me to prompt your question so that we have a lively debate today. With this, let me start with you, Mr. Azami. The November 21st attack in Kabul against minority Shiite gathering was the latest of many similar attacks claimed by IS. Do we know at this stage for sure that it was indeed an attack orchestrated by IS affiliates?
Well, looking into the attacks, one thing is very clear, that Islamic State from the Middle East, through their official news agency, IMAK, claimed the responsibility for the attacks that were carried against the Shias in Afghanistan and also in other part of the country. So, that's one. The other thing is that talking to Afghan officials and also sources within the militants, including Taliban, that are watching ISIS activities very closely, they also confirm. But one thing that I would like to note here is that, all the attacks were not exclusively those of ISIS. ISIS was also had the assistance of other groups that are operating in Afghanistan-Pakistan region, particularly for the attacks on Shia. Lashkar-e-Jangvi, I'm informed that they were supporting ISIS on this attack. And going back to one attack, which was in Kabul in Ashura days, there was in Kartes-Sakhi area, there was one attack, and ISIS published the photo of one attacker, but actually there were two more attackers. When I reached out to sources on the militant side, so they told me that yes, ISIS was aware of only one attacker, and that was their attacker, but the other two that were used in the same attack were coming from Lashkar-e-Jangvi. So that's how it is.
The Kabul-style attack also took place last month in Ghor province, in which 30 people were killed. The IS was accused in orchestrating the attack, but the Afghan Analysts Network investigation shows that the attackers were in fact a gang of criminals. IS accusation was just a cover-up. My question in terms of the Kabul attack, which is significant in number of deaths, also because of a sectarian angle to that, other than the claims of an attack by the group or few Afghan officials accusing that, what are the hard evidences that we have that establishes the connection of that attack to IS?
Well, when it comes to war, the war attack was never claimed by ISIS. None of their people associated to them ever confirmed that. Or like I said, MMAC never claimed that attack. I think it's if we look at it, it's not always attacks against Shia. There was also another attack in Kabul, and that targeted the VIP protection unit actually in Kabul near the Ministry of Defense. That was also ISIS, and ISIS claimed the responsibility. So I think it would be very difficult to say that how can we identify except that they claim. I mean, if we look at whenever there's an attack from the Taliban, they just claim it through their spokesperson and publishes sometimes the photo of the attacker. So I think that's that tells that they are behind it. So I think we don't have any other strong evidence that prove ISIS involvement except for the claim and the photo that they come up with.
Abu Bakr, IS also claimed attacks in remote regions in Balochistan province of Pakistan, both against Sunnis and Shiite soldiers. Similar attacks have been taking place in various regions in Afghanistan, claimed again by IS or accused IS was behind that. If all were to be believed, it means their infiltration is serious. They are organized. There is an existing chain of command, and they are highly dangerous. Is it what you are reading?
Well, the thing is that IS has definitely proved itself to be very resilient in the AFPAC region. I'll just take back our listeners a couple of years back. There was a very insightful article in Dabiq, which is this English language magazine that ISS, Central ISS produces. And this essay was about an IS jihadist hanging out in Waziristan. It was kind of his eyewitness account. So what I draw from reading that article are two conclusions. One is that the IS in Afghanistan and Pakistan is being organized or orchestrated by some Arab jihadists, people who were associated or friends with al-Zarqawi, the former al-Qaeda leader in Iraq, whose followers later on formed we today know as the Islamic State. The other significant part of this puzzle is that, of course, they are a haven for disgruntled jihadists of all stripes. So they have attracted people from, for instance, from Lashkar-e-Tayyiba in Pakistan, from Afghan Taliban, from Pakistani Taliban, TTP, from the Chinese ETIM, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan. And also, the most intriguing part is this emergence of the IS or Islamic State in Balochistan, which is, I think, perhaps the most less known part of IS presence or in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Let me go to Chris here. Chris, first of all, your take on what we discussed so far about the presence of IS in Afghanistan, in Pakistan. Second, infiltration of IS in Afghanistan and also Pakistan. What is the military view on that? Obviously, you are being someone with inside knowledge of military operations in the region.
A couple of things to bear in mind or that are of interest is first of all, Afghanistan has not been a country that has been hospitable in the past towards sectarian violence. So I think the long-term trajectory of Islamic State in fomenting sectarian violence is going to be unsuccessful in Afghanistan, as hard as they might be trying to stoke that sort of civil war like they've done in Iraq and are capitalizing on in Syria. I think second of all, it really points to the challenges of governance, both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and where groups like IS are able to thrive are in poorly governed places where maybe the government's predatory or the government doesn't quite exist as robustly as it should. And these militants are able to fill this vacuum, either capitalizing on popular discontent or on these unsecured, ungoverned spaces. And that's where IS poses a threat. Now, the good news is on the Afghanistan side of the border, at least in Nangarhar and in the east, that their footprint has been shrinking, just due to popular intolerance of, their presence in there and their brutal tactics, among the population.
My question was, what is the view of the military? I mean, the coalition forces on increasing attacks, on increasing infiltration of IS in the Afghanistan. How serious they take it?
Well, I think the coalition and the Afghan government and the Taliban, quite frankly, all take the IS threat seriously. It is one of those threats that seems to be contained. It has a, as Abu Bakr mentioned, it is sort of a catch-all for all the disgruntled militants of various types. So I think they're, at least as things stand now, their footprint and their potential for expansion is limited. And both from the coalition side and the Afghan government side, they've been focusing on finding where these IS cells are and striking them. And as a result, their footprint and their capabilities have been reduced quite substantially in 2016.
Chris, you keep saying that potential of their expansion is limited. But again, the story of Al-Qaeda coming to Afghanistan wasn't similar?
Well, Al-Qaeda came to Afghanistan and sort of grew in Afghanistan based on the anti-Soviet jihad. And that's where they got a lot of their traction. And they weren't, quite frankly, a group that was focused on sectarian violence. They were a group that was trying to support or was interested in supporting the various Mujahideen groups against the Soviets and the Afghan communist government. I think what you've got today is something very, very different in a group that is oriented primarily on terrorist violence and particularly terrorist violence against the Shia population. So I think the context of the two organizations is very different. Of course, you do have some more growth, or at least reported growth, of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, which is probably a more significant longer-term threat than IS is.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Marvin, how much Washington is concerned about the recent spike of attacks by IS throughout the region at the time when Washington is planning to leave the country?
Yes, but any time ISIS or Islamic State is mentioned here, it gets a lot of attention. So the mere fact that they have established a presence in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, too, gains attention. And this is fed in a way by elements in Afghanistan, for example, in the Kabul government, who recognize that one way to keep the U.S. interested in the region is to hype, if you will, the presence of Islamic State in that country. Because we have, especially under this coming administration, we've made it very clear that we were going to be pursuing Islamic State wherever it was and crushing it. So this, in a way, means, I think, that whatever our diminished role is in the region, it's going to be one in which we're going to be focused on their presence there. And I think it's going to be one of those factors which is going to keep us involved in the region well beyond when we had hoped to step out. Let me just go back to this claims of responsibility. I think what we have here, as much as anything, is an organization that is competing for attention. It's very much in competition with in Afghanistan, particularly with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And these rather spectacular attacks are the best way in which they can say we are a factor here. And attacking, I think, Shia makes it even more, they think, more appealing to various groups, particularly as they try to bring over dissident groups from the Taliban and elsewhere. So I see this as much as anything as a jockeying for position among the groups, all trying to, as much as possible, gain attention and, through attention, gaining funding and recruits.
Okay, thank you very much, Marvin. You mentioned that attack on Shia might be a strategy on the ISIS behalf. So let's dive a little bit into this, Mr. Azamis. Where are the people who call themselves ISIS affiliates are populated in the region? And what number of people are we talking about today?
Just briefly, before I go to your question, let me tell you some of my observations, and then I'll come to your question. You know, since its emergence in 2014, in late 2014, and then in January 2015, when ISIS from Iraq and Syria, they officially announced their branch in Khorasan, which Afghanistan is heard of Khorasan and includes parts of Pakistan and then Central Asia, Iran, and China's Xinjiang province. So I was closely following everything about ISIS, from interviewing Rauf Khadim, the deputy emir, on 31st January, you know, in 2007, when he was released from Guantanamo, he visited our office when I was not there. And recently, one of my very detailed assessment in a chapter about ISIS, Daesh threat in Afghanistan, the challenges and prospects the group is facing, this was out, and I have given a very detailed assessment of what the status of the group and what the likely future could be. So let me tell you that we have in Afghanistan and in the region, this threat is very is not given attention, and I think we should not downplay it. It's a serious threat and requires serious attention. And if we continue to do that, it will become a very major problem that we will be unable to solve it.
In which way it's going to be a major problem? Can you be a little bit specific, Mr. Azam?
Yeah. You know, we have to understand that what is the determination of Islamic State towards this region and why they want to, and what's the importance of this region towards Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Let me tell you, their expansion to Afghanistan or Khorasan was the first expansion outside of Iraq and Syria. And this tells how significant it is. Second, in the Islamic prophecies, Khorasan has a very, very important place. And so without having a footprint here, the global jihadi agenda of ISIS will be absolutely defective. And for that, Afghanistan is very important for ISIS.
Obviously, these are really theoretical strong arguments, but then why ISIS wasn't able to expand in Afghanistan? It's already been like 2 years since we are talking about this, and they are limited with few tiny areas in somewhere in the mountains in eastern Afghanistan, isn't it?
I think, you know, I was looking into the ISIS casualties, and since July 2015 until July 2016, they were losing 200 men every month, like averagely speaking. So despite fighting, look, they're fighting the Afghan Taliban, which is probably strongest in this region, in Afghanistan. They are fighting the Afghan government. They are fighting Pakistan, the Pakistani government. They are fighting, everyone is fighting against them, but still they were able to survive and remain relevant. Not only relevant, but their attacks are increasing. And this tells about their potency and how much stronger they are. And we cannot ignore this. The discourse is here that, okay, they were defeated. You know, we reached to a point that a lot of people were saying ISIS is defeated, but it's back and even deadlier. So I think when we compare their recruitment with their casualties, the recruitment is much higher, and the ground is the environment is quite conducive for them, unfortunately, to have more recruits. What they are doing is, look, they're investing on young kids that are as young as 8. And when they grow, they will be even deadlier than someone who joins militancy at a older age. You see, what else they're doing is growing and fueling the Salafist ideology, particularly in the East and also in the North, which will have long-term payoffs. So we have to consider them very seriously.
Okay,
let
me bring here, I think, Chris, you have a different opinion on that, and I know, Marvin, you have slightly different opinion on this. Abu Bakr, I hear that you also want to jump in. So the floor is open. Mr. Azami is saying that we shouldn't be downplaying the threat of ISIS. Who wants to jump in?
Well, if Chris and Marvin will allow me, I'll just make a few quick points. I think that the IS, it's true, as Azami elaborated, that they have this global agenda and they have grand ambitions. But if you look at how they conducted themselves, they have made huge mistakes. They have completely dissociated themselves from local politics, which in my view has proven disastrous for them. For example, the IS controlled something like 6 to 9 districts in eastern Afghanistan last year. They overran these districts, mostly inhabited by the Shinwari Pashtun tribes in Nangarhar province, which borders Pakistan in the east. And then they engage in horrific atrocities. I mean, forcing civilians to sit on bombs and blowing them. I mean, these are horrible images that they disseminated on social media. I mean, this united everybody. We should not forget that the Taliban are now their deadliest enemies in Afghanistan. They are not even the mainstream of Salafism in Afghanistan, because in Afghanistan, the many different stripes of Salafis, they are one part of the Takfiris, and they are very few in number, even among the Eastern Salafi movement in Afghanistan. And the other thing is that unlike all the other militant or most other militant movements, particularly Taliban, they have no covert support from regional states. And I once wrote a piece about how Iran, Russia, Pakistan, the Afghan government, NATO, and even the Taliban are united on one thing in Afghanistan, and that is fighting the IS. I mean, this has prevented them from achieving any kind of tangible political objectives, if they have some.
Okay, Abu Bakr, you are saying that the entire region is united, at least on one thing, and that is to fight against ISIS. So despite that, they are in Afghanistan. They are expanding their attacks throughout the region. They are resilient. It doesn't show that they are committed and they are up to something.
Yeah, can I jump in on this? Because I don't know whether they really are as united as you say. I think what we have seen here is there has been at times tolerance of one another, even collaboration. Certainly, there may have been elements here, of course, of the Pakistan Taliban who participated in the attack in Quetta. So it's a more fluid situation. Also, let me add here that we have, in judging their strength now and in the future, we have to consider the extent to which it's going to be fueled by dissension within the other organizations. Because after all, they have gotten a foothold because of defections that have occurred because of leadership struggles, particularly within the Taliban. So to the extent that the Taliban continue to have the fractionalization we've seen, they have the potential for growth. But should there be a more cohesive Taliban at this point, I think this would pose somewhat a limitation on their future growth.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Taliban connection to the IS. And yesterday I saw a report by Guardian saying that Taliban is out of cash. What does this say going forward to IS's future in Afghanistan or the region then, Marvin?
Well, I think it makes them more vulnerable. It makes those elements here that, for example, aren't getting paid more amenable to perhaps finding another banner to fly under. This is, let me add one more thing here. I'm not certain that we've seen enough proof of the command structure of Islamic State such that we can really make the case that its links to Iraq and Syria are as strong as perhaps some people are claiming they are. There's no question that every effort is made here to claim that these are our men. But remember, for example, we had an event here in the United States yesterday, which involved a student from originally from Somalia, but educated in Pakistan, who had a knife attack and a car attack against students. And immediately, of course, Islamic State took credit for this. Well, he may have been influenced by them, but the idea that somehow he was ordered to do this, there's no evidence of that. And I think we can make the same kind of case in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, that these are probably almost entirely locally initiated attacks.
Okay.
If I could hold on both what Abu Bakr and Marvin have said, and also address this issue of the Islamic State threat. I think Abu Bakr is exactly right that they – Islamic State in at least the cells in Afghanistan have made huge mistakes in terms of alienating the population through their atrocities. They've demonstrated poor and fractious leadership. They've got limited resources. And in fact, if their main benefactors are from the primary group in Iraq and Syria, that group, of course, has much more pressing concerns than funding the cell in Afghanistan. And their appeal is quite limited, both due to the atrocities
due to the poor leadership, due to the fact that they're just a terrorist group. They're not focused on governance or working together with people. And in fact, they're just a catch-all for all of these various disgruntled groups. And so they've almost self-selected in a way that is going to limit them to this sort of fringe lunatic group that is certainly does pose a threat, as we have seen on November 21st and in other instances, poses a threat of being able to carry out terrorist activities. But in terms of is it an existential threat to the Afghan government or a threat that of a serious international terrorist organization? Not yet, and at least not to the scale of a threat to the Afghan government that the Taliban is, or a threat of large-scale international terrorist attacks as al-Qaeda is. So I think it's important to put the group into context and recognize its current limitations and challenges. Now, all that being said, I think Mr. Azami makes some very important points in that it could have some longer-term potential. And as Marvin mentioned, if the Taliban continues to have major leadership challenges, if the Afghan government continues to have major leadership challenges, and if Islamic State in Afghanistan manages to begin to get its act together as an organization that might have appeal beyond just very disgruntled individuals and actually begins to compete for support within Afghanistan. If you've got this situation of the Taliban and the government both losing support and this group getting its act together, then you could have potential for a longer term, more significant threat from IS.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting stuff, Chris. Now, after several months of conflicting reports about whether IS is indeed present in the region, today we are not only talking about level of its presence, but also how dangerous it become. Now, the question is, what is that IS is really looking for in Afghanistan or Pakistan? What are its objectives? What lies behind their Khorasan dream? And what their objectives mean to various regional actors? We will continue to discuss all this shortly. But first, let me recap the debate that today on the Gandhara podcast, Arafi Arel's Pakistan in Afghanistan talk show, we are looking at the recent spike of attacks by the alleged IS affiliates and their motivations in the region. Discussing the subject with me are Marvin Winbaum, former State Department analyst on Pakistan in Afghanistan. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. Christopher Colinda is joining us from London, who's senior military fellow at the King's College. Hikmatullah Azami is with us from Kabul. He is the researcher at the Center for Conflict and Peace Studies in Kabul. Abu Bakr Siddiq, who is the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, focusing on Afghanistan and Pakistan, is joining us from Prague today. And I'm Mohammed Tahir here in Washington, D.C. Once again, welcome back, gentlemen, to the Gandhara podcast. So there are already enough militant groups of various type in the region. They are and have been engaged in the same war for decades, which IS does. Then what was the attraction for IS to come to establish a branch in this war-torn region? Who wants to take this question?
Yeah, I was disconnected for a while, but I hope I did not miss. So I would like to point out certain things about the link between ISIS in Afghanistan, the Khorasan in ISIS. You know, if we go to the big 13th issue, there is very crystal clear that, okay, there's an interview from their former Khorasan governor, Hafiz Saeed Khan, and it's very clear, like, the attack they carried out against the Pakistani consulate, and it was reported there. So I think there should not be an issue on that. And also, we should not be distracted by the speculations that are surrounded. I mean, you know, I've mentioned this in so many events and so many times that, look, the speculations against ISIS is only helping ISIS. And there are three prevalent ones. It's a, you know, it's an American project, like the normal one that wants to threaten Iran or Russia or China, or the other one is even for the Afghan government that, okay, they want to fight militancy with Islamist militancy, and the third is Pakistan. Some even believe it's an Indian project. So we should not be distracted with such speculations. It's a we should consider it a true threat. And now let me tell you about how what they are doing and how stronger they are. ISIS, when it emerged, it was a dividing force, causing splits within militant groups. IMU was one of the very few groups that pledged allegiance. But then there was a serious fight between Taliban and IMU and ISIS. But now what appears that, okay, they are becoming a unifying force where ISIS is able to work with different groups. And even Taliban have toned down the response or the level up animosity between the two groups is not as serious under the new Taliban leadership, Haybatullah Akhundzada, as it used to be, because Akhtar Mohammad Mansour was very strong. So, and it seems that ISIS is now the second largest group after Taliban that is operating. And one more point. I think, yes, ISIS made a lot of mistakes, political mistakes, whatever you want to call. But I think it is the violence that buys ISIS and other groups a place and influence. You know, if we consider that, okay, Taliban did not really deliver anything post 2001, but they were welcomed just because they were cruel. They did so many things to people. They threatened people. And ISIS is taking that to another level. And I think that will, unfortunately, will win them over a place. And I told the other day to Abu Bakr Siddiq that I believe and I fear that ISIS will be a future of militancy in Afghanistan-Pakistan region. Mm. Because, you know, even they're able to convince Taliban to join. And one guy was telling me, and that's very surprising, that whenever we talk to a Taliban guy and we say, do you believe in Hadith? Of course they do. And we tell them that Prophet Muhammad predicted the black turban that will rise from Khorasan. So, and we are that force. So do you believe in that or not? And the Taliban cannot say no. And the moment they say no, they will be not considered Muslim. Mm. So that worries me the most. And okay. That's why I argue that we need to pay very serious and closer attention to ISIS.
Obviously, there are more than one interpretation of the situation on how ISIS has emerged. Some say that, like Marvin, that they are just a few franchised Taliban gangs, but some others, like you say, Azami, is that they are part of a real ISIS. And then you have ISIS people in Syria talking about their Khorasan province, for instance. It seems that there is some sort of organization and connection. We know what IS stand for in the Middle East. In this frame, what we know about their objectives in Pakistan, in Afghanistan? Who wants to take this question?
Well, if I can pitch in, I think in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the main, obviously there's this main Khorasan group, but its future and objectives are linked to the central IS in Iraq and Syria. And right now they are under tremendous military pressure. Right. So as long as that group was ascendant, IS kind of posed more threat. But as long as, that group is now, pretty much everybody in the region agrees that IS has to go, and they're being attacked by all sides. So that is one of the things. The other thing is that the Taliban are basically an Afghanistan-specific thing, and that's one of the reasons that keeps them relevant. That's why people are eager to join, to talk to them. Even the current U.S. strategy for Afghanistan-Pakistan recognizes the need to reach some kind of reconciliation, deal with them, and that's been pursued during the past 5 years or 6 years. But thinking of something similar with IS is kind of a bit too far, because if they couldn't reach any kind of agreement or deal with communities in remote mountains in eastern Afghanistan, how can they sit and talk to Kabul? And apart from conspiracy theories, one thing is very clear, that the ferocity of their violence has made them enemies of everybody in the region. And nobody is absolutely in their sane mind is, I don't see anybody willing to trust them.
The fact that whatever the size, strength of IS might be, they are today present in Afghanistan. And when talking about their objectives, Afghan officials would say that their interests are not local. They are here because of their interests across the border in Central Asia. And you would hear similar statements coming from Russia or some of the Central Asian countries. How much of this official statement's rhetoric is fact, and how much of that is just a fiction?
Well, the very fact that they use the term Khorasan, I think, suggests that they do think that there is a reason to be present in the region. An alternative way to look at what some of the things Abu Bakr was saying is, if their core forces in Iraq and Syria begin to be squeezed hard and, in fact, even eliminated, I think a question to be raised here is, if Islamic State is more than simply the core, then will indeed the periphery organizations become more important to them? Will they, for example, particularly if Afghanistan begins to fragment, if it becomes more and more ungoverned space, will this seem like fertile ground to keep alive the spark of Islamic State, very much the way in which Al-Qaeda took advantage of ungoverned space back in the 90s? So, you know, as far as Central Asia is concerned, we believe that the groups like IMU have worked together with Islamic State, and obviously they have another agenda. But I think you can make the case here that the Afghanistan-Pakistan theater would be one of interest to Islamic State. The question really is, how far can they go? And what we're saying here, I think, is they've got competition. They're not in it alone, and the competition, I think, has some advantages that they don't have, and I think a number of the remarks today have brought that out.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll hold on that, too, if there's an opportunity to do so. I think Marvin raises some very interesting points, and a particular concern is, as Islamic State in Iraq and Syria is put under further military pressure, and as potentially as their defeat in that region becomes ever closer, is there a risk that we will see some migration of militants from Iraq and Syria into Afghanistan and Pakistan? I think that's a very real concern and something worthy of a lot of international attention to track. That being said, this also points to some of the major challenges that we've all mentioned about Islamic State, Khorasan province, and their poor leadership and alienation of the population. Even if there is a migration from the Middle East, or an effort to migrate from the Middle East into Afghanistan and Pakistan, they don't exactly have a very welcome environment because of all of the competition. Now, an interesting wrinkle in all of this, I think, is the role of Pakistan. And Abu Bakr mentioned some of the sort of concerns about conspiracy theories, if you will. But if the relationship between the Afghan Taliban and Pakistan continues to atrophy, will Pakistan look to support an alternative group like IS in efforts to maintain degrees of instability within Afghanistan? I think that's something that would be very interesting to examine and to look at, to see if you do begin to see stronger links between IS and Pakistan. And then my final point is, I think on this difference between Islamic State and the Afghan Taliban, it really strikes at this issue of insurgency versus terrorism. The Afghan Taliban is an insurgent group. It wants to govern. It has made a lot of changes since 2001 to make themselves more appealing within certain parts of the Afghan population, acknowledging the fact that they engage in a lot of despicable activity. Whereas Islamic State, Khorasan province, is at this point a terrorist group. They are just simply seeking to maximize civilian casualties. They're seeking to maximize instability, but as yet have demonstrated little or have laid out no political program and have demonstrated little ability to gain any sort of public support within Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting discussion, obviously, but we are running out of time. But final point is, now In the United States, a new team is coming to an office. President Trump has a tough message on IS in Syria, and he has an advisor on the same page with deep knowledge of Afghanistan. What to expect from Washington going forward under the Trump administration when it comes to Afghanistan and these militants of various type?
I think the feeling here is that it will not be high on the agenda of the new administration in foreign policy. To the extent that they will have a foreign policy perspective at all, it will be with regard to Syria and trying to sort out the relationship with the Russians and the Syrian government. And so unless there is a major development, I don't think that there are many people here in Washington who think that we're going to be expending much of our time trying to develop a policy toward Afghanistan and Pakistan, aside from the most obvious decision that's going to have to be made, and that is what is going to be our troop level in Afghanistan. But outside of that, given the people who the president-elect has surrounded himself with, there seems every reason to believe that we'll see a continuity rather than any kind of appreciable change in policy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much for your insightful comments, Marvin Winbaum, former State Department analyst on Pakistan in Afghanistan. And also big thanks goes to Christopher Kolinda, senior military fellow at the King's College in London, Hikmatullah Azami, researcher at the Center for Conflict and Peace Studies in Kabul, Abubakar Siddiq, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website focusing on Afghanistan in Pakistan. Once again, thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining our podcast today.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. Welcome. This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of Gandhara. Until next episode, bye-bye.